Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
National Review says it is against Trump. Bernie Sanders says Planned Parenthood is the establishment, and Flint, Michigan is still waiting for drinkable tap water. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenheuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation. And our special guest is Jameel Smith, senior editor at The New Republic. Welcome to all of you. So Rich had a big week. National Review just came out with a whole anti-Trump issue headlined Against Trump, with arguments from about two dozen speakers across the conservative spectrum about why Donald Trump is so terrible. Here's what Trump had to say about that in Las Vegas on Thursday.
Look, the National Review is a dying paper. It's got its circulation's way down. Not very many people read it anymore. I mean, people don't even think about the National Review. So I guess they want to get a little publicity. But, you know, that's a dying paper.
Rich, tell us what the thinking was behind this issue and what you've made of the reaction from Trump and others.
Well, there are a couple purposes. One, it's just been so tiresome over the last 8 months, the argument you hear over and over again from Trump supporters that it's only the establishment that opposes Donald Trump, when it's really a lot of principled conservatives. So we wanted to go out and get people from across the conservative spectrum, libertarians, religious conservatives, old Reagan hands, young upstarts, neocons, non-neocons, to make the case that Donald Trump is a mistake for conservatives. And this is what we see our role as holding up the banner of American conservatism without fear or favor. And perhaps it's going to get shot down, you know, and shot to bits, you know, and we'll be in tatters 3 weeks from now. But we just need to felt the need to make this statement and let the chips fall where they may.
So David Frum has been saying that the rise of Trump is a reflection of the fact that so many core Republican voters are not especially interested in conservative ideology. It's not that they don't realize that he's not a real conservative. It's that they don't care. And I'm wondering, what do you think of that? And if that's right, isn't that an indictment of National Review and other entities that are supposed to be the torchbearers for this ideology? If it's not that Trump is a charlatan, if it's that you guys are just being rejected because your own party doesn't like your ideas, that has to be pretty dispiriting. And,
yeah,
and are
yeah,
you starting
thanks,
to
Josh.
Worry that that's the case?
No, well, a lot of these people do care about ideology. Not all of them, but some of them. And those are the people we're trying to reach. And it's this classic tension within conservatism between populism and conservative ideology. And populism has always been an element of the American right. You know, Bill Buckley himself said, I'd rather be governed by the first 2,000 people in the Boston phone book than the Harvard faculty. But the populism has always been tethered to and in service of the ideological goals. And we see the threat of Trump is cutting that tie and just becoming a populist party. And National Review has always stood against this kind of crude populism.
So what have the two of you, Jameel and Katrina, made of watching this infighting on the right? Because I was on Chris Hayes' show on MSNBC last night, and it's like almost unseemly how giddy Chris is. Like, he's really, really enjoying himself watching this. And I think that's true of a lot of people on the left. They're sort of watching this fight happily.
Well, I believe we're a better country if you have two serious political parties. We should have many more in this country, in fact. And it's a question, it seems, at this moment, whether conservatism is a clear and coherent ideology or whether we've seen it hijacked by the right fringe of a conservative movement that's tried too hard to adjust itself to the demands of an angry Tea Party or Freedom Caucus. I'm not giddy about this. I think it's quite fascinating. And finally, our national affairs correspondent, William Grider, wrote an interesting piece a few weeks ago about how this is the crack-up of the GOP, that very insidious deal that was struck through Southern strategy between a base and the establishment. Well, the base isn't getting what it wants from the establishment, and it's seen more clearly now that it's been shafted for the last 40, 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not happy about it either, to be honest with you. I feel like you have to make a distinction here between conservatism and republicanism. And I think what's happened here, especially given that the RNC is now taking your magazine Rich out of the debate cycle, I feel like there's definitely, you know, grounds for talking about what's difference between what you argue is conservatism and what the Republican Party is trying to advocate as its platform. Now, as far as the overall effort, though, I felt it came up short because I feel like there's a lack of recognition, I think, of the roots of what Trump is. Mm-hmm. I think the fact is that, unfortunately, you know, in your magazine, over the course of several decades, you know, the roots of this kind of, you know, white populist conservatism have, mm-hmm. you know, been sowed in the pages of the magazine. And I feel like if the evaluation or advocacy against Trump had included, I feel like a more honest look at that, I thought I could have taken it a little bit more seriously.
Rich, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, well, I don't think that's really fair. When George Wallace was running in the 70s, Bill Buckley and National Review were opposing him. And we have always cared about limited government, liberty, and the Constitution. Those are the things we constantly come back to. And we sort of resist this kind of identity politics. The people who represent kind of a white nationalist identity politics hate us and have been expelled from our world. And you go onto Twitter right now, you'll see them calling us very nasty names exactly because we have expelled them. And it's always been the role of National Review to hold up be the conscience of conservatism and to be a sanitizing force within conservatism.
I thought there was this interesting split in the symposium, though. Like, you had John Podoretz, for example, basically making a cultural complaint against Donald Trump and his coarseness, and about his campaign being an extension of his demand that the nation's first black president prove to his satisfaction that he's really an American. Then on the other hand, you have Thomas Sowell basically comparing both Trump and Obama to Hitler and saying that, you know, Trump would be another Obama-like, Hitler-like president. And it seems like if the problem, which Podoretz, I think, was correctly identifying, is that the certain parts of conservatism turned the heat up way too high on the rhetoric about how the left is destroying America, then it's in a symposium at the same place that someone is reprising that rhetoric.
Well, Sowell is really talking about the dangers of unhinged populism and the mob. I think that's what he was getting at, although whenever you raise Hitler, it obviously raises the temperature.
When you raise, you should be thrown out of the political court of no, but I do think Jamil raises an interesting question. Eric Alterman, in his column for us on the 60th anniversary of National Review, there are certainly different William Buckleys and different National Reviews. It is the case that he tried to sanitize conservatism at a certain moment. He was against demagogues. He was for an intelligent populism. He was for anti-elitism. But there is a measure of xenophobia, homophobia, in as late as 1986, Buckley was writing about AIDS victims and said they should be tattooed in the upper forearm.
He regretted that one. And I mean, we all have things that we regret, and they're all things, if we rummage through our magazine's past, that we wouldn't be particularly proud of or wouldn't stand up by contemporary standards. But we have always seen that as part of our role, and we may have fulfilled it imperfectly, but it's something we've sought to do and still do today.
But could I ask Rich, what interested me was we've just endorsed four Bernie Sanders. Yours was very much anti-Trump. I have not had a chance to look at the magazine, but in it, do you begin to try and lay out what is a coherent conservative ideology for these times, or is that a project that will come later?
Yes, the editorial board is divided on who they like. We know we're opposed to Trump.
Kind of like the party.
Consistently, the things we think can be learned from Trump is, one, to take immigration more seriously and take it seriously mm-hmm. as an economic issue, and also to develop a working class economics that addresses some of these discontents in a much more responsible way. And we've been banging on that one for several years with limited success, unfortunately.
It's sort of like David Brooks. I'm sorry. Didn't he say that the Republican Party should a troika of Huey Long, Chuck Colson, and a third. His ideal is probably Hayek.
Is
somewhere
Rick,
in there.
Is this your Rick Perry moment, Katrina?
The what?
Is this your Rick Perry moment? You can't remember what the third was.
It was so stunning to me.
There was this kind of wistful Ross Douthat column this week, because Ross is one of these conservative writers who's been pushing for some sort of recalibration of the party's agenda more toward the middle class. But he's saying, like, look, you know, for years I've been saying we need bigger child tax credits and other things that really matter for middle-income people. But maybe what these people really want is Trumpism. It's not clear to Ross that, like, the answer that would have stopped Donald Trump is that, you know, wonky policy agenda aimed at the middle class.
Just one point on that. We haven't seen this expression anywhere else, in a governor, in a, you know, member of the House, in a senator. So to some extent, it is sui generis to Trump and his gut-level political skill and showmanship.
I want to talk about one non-National Review related aspect of this, which is that, you know, obviously you've seen elements of the establishment rising up against Trump, including National Review. But you've also had this slew of statements this week from people like Bob Dole and Trent Lott saying that they would rather have Donald Trump as the nominee than Ted Cruz. And I think that there are two ways to look at this. One is that, you know, people, for whatever set of reasons, so hate Ted Cruz that anything is better. The other interesting theory is that a lot of these people are Jeb Bush endorsers, and that they've been sent out by the Jeb campaign to say this to undermine Marco Rubio, which sounds too complicated to be true. But the idea is basically, if the establishment is so afraid of Cruz that they're throwing their hands up and throwing their lot in with Trump, what they're saying is, we have decided that Marco Rubio has no chance. It makes him look stupid. And then I guess the idea is everybody gets blown up through the course of the first few primaries, and all that's left is Trump and then Jeb Bush, who nobody really likes, but he sits on a giant pile of money. It's dumb, but
don't underestimate sincerity in politics. Whoa, people sincerely loathe Ted Cruz. The senators, the lobbyists, any insider who's had a dealing with him in Washington really hates him. And that's the main motive for the statements you've seen from Bob Dole and others.
And in fact, that actually ties in with my favorite theory, which is that they are actually willing to just let this presidential race go. Mm-hmm. And instead of actually giving Cruz a nomination platform and fearing that he would be next in line for the next presidential race or win and potentially dominate the party for the next decade.
And that's another reason.
My sense, though, but the sincerity factor is an important one. My sense is people like Dole are really frightened by this committed movement activist Ted Cruz is. But I think this goes on. Rich may disagree. I think this goes on with a number of candidates because they got their sugar daddies. You know, Cruz has establishment money coming into his pockets. People may hate him.
And he hasn't spent much of it at all.
I mean, I wouldn't disregard the infrastructure.
But this is just one other reason we came out with this big anti-Trump statement. It is so frustrating. You have an establishment that hasn't really fought Trump at all. There's been no negative advertising against him at all. And before anyone caucuses and votes, they're surrendering to him. It's completely pathetic and feckless.
Well, let us know what you think about Donald Trump establishmentarian at kcrw.com/LRC on our Facebook page or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Bernie Sanders says Planned Parenthood is the establishment. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel, stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times and MSNBC. On the left is Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And Jamil Smith, host of the New Republic podcast Intersection, is also with us. So Bernie Sanders this week was being interviewed by Rachel Maddow, and here is what he said about Planned Parenthood and the Human Rights Campaign.
We're taking on not only Wall Street and the economic establishment, we're taking on the political establishment. So I have friends and supporters in the Human Rights Fund, in Planned Parenthood. But you know what? Hillary Clinton has been around there for a very, very long time. And some of these groups are, in fact, part of the establishment.
The Human Rights Campaign, of course, is the large LGBT rights lobby. Jamil, this was kind of an odd comment. You wrote about it this week.
Indeed. And I felt like it's a kind of a trap that Bernie Sanders continues to fall into when it comes to social justice issues. I feel like there's, you know, certain comfort that he has when he's not either ready for a question or he's simply not prepared for it. When he just kind of goes to his simple anti-establishment boilerplate lines. But here, you know, there's just not, he wasn't either, you know, ready to talk about this particular thing. And I just felt like he, you know, it fails when he is trying to label Planned Parenthood, narrow pro-choice America, and Human Rights Campaign as establishment, you know, just because they're not backing his candidacy.
But aren't these establishment organizations? I mean,
First of all, the Nation, which endorsed Bernie Sanders last week, let's look at his candidacy for a minute. I mean, he is unbought. He's running an insurgent campaign to tell the truth about a rigged system in this country, rigged political and economic inequality that is very much also about gender and race. He had encounters with Black Lives Matter, as did Hillary Clinton last summer. He's come up with the best racial justice platform. Jamil may disagree. Planned Parenthood is not establishment in the sense that it's a vital service for women that is under attack. I mean, there's security problems around this country, denying women and low-income, poor women. So there is a problem Bernie Sanders sometimes has when confronted with issues of racial and gender equality. He devolves to a different – It's not a modern stance, but he is evolving. He's evolving. I do think that to answer your question, Josh, Bernie Sanders wasn't attacking the mission or good works of these organizations. He's taking aim at their political strategy. It is the case that Planned Parenthood raises millions of dollars, that the story in the New York Times a few days ago, which was quite stunning, that the Hillary Clinton campaign has basically devoted resources between Iowa and its Brooklyn headquarters and is relying on labor support and Planned Parenthood in the field, suggests it's a major, big-funded, well-funded organization. But Jamil reminded me of the importance of nuance when we got into the studio. And nuance is important, and I think to call Planned Parenthood establishment is not the right way to go. And Bernie Sanders knows that's not the case. He could have handled it better.
I just feel like this is a symptom of the fact that we've, like, I mean, establishment institutions have screwed up in a lot of big ways over the last, you know, well, at least the last decade and more. And so people are upset about generically the establishment for this reason. But I think the pendulum's swung too far, and people basically, you know, associate the word establishment with a negative thing. And therefore, you can't say something nice about the establishment, and no establishment organization can be a good one. And I think it seems sort of self-evidently true that, like, the Human Rights Campaign, if you've seen their building in Washington, D.C., their big, shiny building, like, they raise a ton of corporate money. They are often criticized by more left-wing LGBT rights groups mm-hmm. for being too cozy mm-hmm. with big corporate mm-hmm. interests. There are also strong arguments in favor of the Human Rights Campaign that they've done a lot to advance LGBT equality, but they are clearly a part of the establishment. And I think people ought to be able to talk about good things and bad things that the establishment does without sort of casting it all away.
Right. But my issue with his comments is not necessarily identifying them as establishment, but saying that he, because they are part of the establishment, is planning to take them on. That is the problem.
Yeah.
And an establishment which has been under assault this past year, Planned Parenthood. I mean, how do you define establishment? The bigger problem and issue in my mind is how the mainstream media, to the establishment, has defined Hillary Clinton as someone of experience, of head, and Bernie Sanders not electable because he's all passion and heart and idealism versus pragmatism. I would suggest that experience is only so good if you draw the right lessons, you don't have poor judgment. And it certainly experience hasn't worked well in these last few years to deal with the greatest catastrophes we've seen, financial, with the healthcare, with other things. I think it's a mistake to equate experience with head.
Rich, I mean, I feel like this, again, is a mirror of what we're seeing on the right with, you know, if we're talking about establishment institutions under attack, look at Donald Trump trying to take over the Republican Party. Does somebody need to be sticking up for the establishment and arguing that the establishment is what stands between us and anarchy?
Well, I think the establishment is so ill-defined mm-hmm. at the moment. You know, I'd say it's on the Republican side. It's basically high-elected officials, senators, members of the House leadership, lobbyists, donors, consultants have been around forever. But you look even within that group, they disagree about big things. You know, and some of them are much more conservative, and some of them are much more moderate. So it's kind of a useful. It's the best time to be anti-establishment because the establishment is hated. At the moment, actually, it has much less power than it ever has. Plus, on the Republican side, it's fractured between several candidates. And it seems to me, you know, I was talking to Katrina before the show, my attitude is kind of one cheer for Bernie Sanders, because he is out there with a passionate sincerity, who is an ideologue in the best sense of the word. And he does, I don't have the fine-grained sense of how this Planned Parenthood and human rights campaign kerfuffle plays out in Democratic politics, but it does seem to me there is legitimately an establishment coming down on his head. Every elected official pretty much is against him. He's gone from, you know, a charming eccentric about a week ago now to a dangerous socialist. They've added a forum on Monday, probably to prop Hillary up the same way they tried to suppress the prior debates to prop Hillary up. And if you're kind of an American and have an American's kind of natural appreciation for the underdog, you kind of got to be rooting for Bernie in a way.
You know, New Yorker writer Richard Revere wrote a book called The Establishment. I think it was in 1954. Rich is right. The establishment is fractured. It's been fracturing for a decade now, not just in the light of this election. What that means, to me, it means the old order in a more broader sense. The old order is disappearing and dying. A new one is not yet born. We're in a moment when every institution is under stress. And it's not just post-great financial crisis. But I think it's important to see, coming back to Bernie and Hillary, in some of the commentary, and Jamil may agree or disagree, Jonathan Chait, John Alter, even Paul Krugman, there is a kind of sense that the gatekeepers of the liberal establishment are being challenged by the Bernie Sanders candidacy, and they are not going to let him go through as easily. And that's, you know, fine to do a little hazing, but I see that in it.
Well, my particular issue with Bernie Sanders in this week's events, not just the Planned Parenthood remark, but also his opposition to reparations, is that he does not appeal necessarily to an African-American electorate in the same way that Hillary Clinton might, not just because of the lack of experience, but also because there seems to be a limitation to his optimism. There seems to be a limit on exactly how far this political revolution that he's advocating for is going to go. And it's not necessarily going to, and I'm not saying this is actually the fact, but I'm not, you know, I see a lot of voters, black voters, who are disillusioned with white men promising them things, and something we've been hearing our entire lives. And while his optimism is refreshing, I feel like a lot of people are looking for someone who they know can perform the duties of the job.
I want to get quickly to one more issue, speaking of reasons people distrust institutions, what's happened in Flint, Michigan, and the contamination of the city's water system with lead. Katrina, you wrote about this week and about sort of national lessons we can draw from it.
Well, I think it's more than just a human catastrophic failure, even more than a political failure. I argue that it's a direct consequence of decades of policies based on the premise that government spending is always a problem, never a solution. I think it's also, we're witnessing the intersection of austerity and race. Flint, poor, majority African American, and it's about poverty and race and the corrosion of our political system and our water pipes. It is a lesson for America. If we don't draw real change and accountability from this, then our political system is as corroded as those pipes in Flint. But we got to focus on race, class, place.
One thing that strikes me about this story is, you know, looking at the mechanics of what went wrong, is that looking at what the state did, it looks to me like the key failure was a regulatory failure rather than a fiscal one, which is that basically it would have been fine to change the water source if they had properly monitored it and implemented a corrosion control program where they softened the water. So, like, it's not that there was a choice between saving money and protecting people, and the city chose saving money. They could have saved money and protected people if the environmental regulators had paid attention
to the right things. That's part of austerity. That's part of gutting of government. That's part of mistrust of government. And that's been the distrust of government, by the way, I think is understandable. When people look at what happened in Flint, this government was captured by big money, by interests. But the gutting of regulations has been a part of our landscape. Think of this clean water, clean air. How do we have those? It's not via immaculate conception. As we sit here, there's a bipartisan gang of people in Washington trying to weaken and soften financial regulations, which in the end may sound sterile, but they too could lead to human damage, and we've seen it.
Rich, what have you made of the national reaction to this? Because I feel like it has had a surprisingly partisan cast, It's been very much about the governor of Michigan, and obviously there were state-level failures that, you know, and we saw email traffic to the governor's office he didn't pay enough attention to, but it seems like people have really tried to put this into a Republican-Democrat frame.
And also a conservative liberal one, where Governor Snyder is not a anti-government fanatic. He's a technocrat. Mm-hmm. And obviously he and his people failed. But so, as you point out, did the regulators at the state level and at the federal level, where they just didn't want to believe the indications they were getting that this was a disaster on their hands. But Flint, you know, it's a decaying municipality that was misgoverned into the ground and was bankrupt. And that's why they're trying to save money. And it had, you know, has to do with the decline of American manufacturing and all other factors. But if you spend a city into the ground, eventually you will run out of money and have to make catastrophic budget cuts.
But you also don't, in that moment, have to, you, if you know that it's spending itself into the ground, you have to then prepare to make tough choices that, you know, not only are going to help revive that city, but also going to protect its people. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to
basic
services here. We're talking about water, and also water that people are continuing to be charged for, we should note. Water that they cannot drink, and I was in Flint in December. Water they cannot drink, water that they can't use to shower, water that they can't use for normal household uses. So this is an American catastrophe.
You know, the thing that really struck me is GM stopped using the water because it was corroding its machine parts. And it knew, the regulators knew, but they didn't alert the citizens. It's like, think about putting profit before people, humanity after austerity.
Well, and the explanation was sort of, well, we thought, you know, GM had especially, you know, special technical needs of the equipment they were running.
We need
water
to say more. Yeah.
Anyway, we've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
A theme in our discussion today has been the use and abuse of the term establishment. Ted Cruz is a great example of this, where every single attack against him, he wants to make it as the establishment is assaulting him. Meanwhile, it's Donald Trump who's calling him a liar and a hypocrite who's ineligible to serve. So the truth, unfortunately, Mr. Cruz, is that you're being savaged by the anti-establishment.
Katrina Vandenheuvel.
I'm excited that the sixth anniversary of Citizens United, which has brought us polluted money and rigged system, two women, one in this city, New York, and one in the state, New York State, one in Washington State, are running against corruption, against monopoly power, for a cleaner system, for a government that works for common good. Zephyr Teachout in the 19th Congressional District, she gave Andrew Cuomo a run for his money when she ran against him for governor last year. And Pramila Jayapal in Washington State in the 7th Congressional District. Both have endorsed Bernie Sanders.
Jamil.
Well, I'd like to bring attention back to my hometown of Cleveland, which this week saw a report emerge from the Cleveland Scene where the Tamir Rice grand jury decision was reached without a vote. Now, I've reached down to the prosecutor's office to find out how this magically happened, how the prosecutor's office, which is supposed to argue for an indictment in that case, managed to argue against it, and there was no vote taken. So I think what we've seen here is further indication that these kinds of prosecutions of police violence cases need to be taken out of the hands of local prosecutors and put in the hands of either state attorney generals or the federal government.
For my rant, sort of contrary to what Katrina said, I just want to point out how we're in a moment of spectacular failure of money in politics. Jeb Bush entered this race with over $100 million given to him by his rich friends that were supposed to intimidate people out of the race and make him impossible to beat. And they've spent a ton of money on advertising that has done not a bit of good. And I realize that there are lots of ways that money influences politics, and there are things other than mega ad spending from super PACs. But I think we have seen over the last couple of election cycles that Republican billionaires pouring tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars into high-profile campaigns has had less effect than either the media or those billionaires themselves thought it would. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenheuvel, and Jamil Smith. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Hannah Tayson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.